Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You work crazy hours, you meet every challenge, and then suddenly, sometime in the last 2 years, a pink slip and 2 weeks severance pay. And before you know it, you're slipping down the American economic ladder. From a well-paying job, you fall into the ranks of the unemployed, and then into a job with less responsibility and less pay. Many Americans have learned that putting a career in reverse is better than going without a paycheck. But it is painful and common enough that it now has a name: downward mobility. Tonight on Point, the economics of backsliding downward mobility and the stories of Americans who are living it right now. We will be following the story of the big power blackout throughout the evening. President Bush is scheduled to speak to the nation at 8:30, and we will go to the president when and if he comes on air to speak. But first, several new economic reports out today. Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. I asked him what the new numbers tell us.
Well, Tom, it's continuing the run of very encouraging signals from the economy. First of all, we had international trade figures for the month of June. It turns out that our exports did quite well and the trade deficit narrowed. So good signs for anybody involved in the exporting business. Jobless claims up a very small amount from 396,000 to 398,000 last week, but that's still below the 400,000 level that we've gotten used to as being sort of the dividing line between a shrinking and a growing job market. And that's on top of some good news from the day before. A very good month for retailers in July, with sales up 1.4%, suggesting a very strong start to consumption in the third quarter. So basically a run of very encouraging data for the economy, Tom.
So when President Bush stands with his economic crew in Crawford, Texas, as he did this week, and says, "We think we're getting things on track here," does it come off as credible right now?
Yes, it absolutely does, Tom. I think that it's a fair thing to say that the signs of the recovery are becoming more and more convincing with each passing day. Now, that said, if they weren't, I'm not sure what else President Bush could say, because frankly, he doesn't have a lot left in his kitty to throw at the economy with the deficit already soaring towards record levels.
So there's not much more he could do. He should be happy if it's all coming together for a more positive outlook. But within that outlook, there is also still a cluster of things that give people a lot of concern. We've got some very difficult long searches for employment, and the stock market seems to have mixed feelings about where things are headed as well.
Yeah, Tom, I would say that if there were two sort of flies in the recovery ointment right now, it would be the job market and the stock market. Now, first with the job market, in spite of these fairly encouraging signs on things like business investment and exports and retail sales, this doesn't yet seem to have translated into any meaningful job growth. The unemployment rate is still over 6%, and surveys show that people are very, very worried about their job security. And one of the reasons for this, Tom, is that companies in the last year or two have become very, very fixated on cutting costs. Any investment they're making these days is not to expand their business or to launch new products. It's to cut costs. Wherever they can replace a human being with a machine that can do it more cheaply and more efficiently, that's what they're going to do. And that's why we have this profound disconnect between the economy, which is growing, and the job market, which is shrinking. And you're picking that up in all sorts of survey evidence.
And on the stock market front, why the hesitancy there?
On the stock market, Tom, it's the same basic problem we've had for 3 or 4 years. Even after a bear market that has basically lasted since early 2000, stocks are still, by most traditional measures, overvalued. A lot of things have to go right really well and really soon to justify the valuations we have in these stocks. Now, it's a fair thing to say the economy is improving, but is it improving enough to justify the expectations for sales and profits that people have embedded in these stock prices? I'm not really sure that it is. And it's troubling when you see that insiders, like the directors and the executives who run these companies, and who you would think know more about the business outlook than anybody else, are selling stock in their own companies in significant volumes. That's kind of troubling. It sort of provokes the question, what do they see that the rest of us don't see?
So some good indicators out there, but still some clouds along the edges. Greg, if the economy continues to improve, can you foresee a point where it feels like good times again? And will that be for everybody, for some? What's the prospect here?
Sure, Tom. I mean, let's step back for a minute. Yes, the job market is very soft. Employment is weak. But it's probably true that most of the time, employment tends to be a bit of a lagging indicator. It's not uncommon that when businesses are very uncertain, they want to sort of like hold off on hiring people until they can be sure that the increase in sales is for real. They don't want to hire somebody just to have to lay them off a month or two later. That's demoralizing and it's expensive. And in fact, in the last few months, despite the very soft performance of the job market, there have been a few signs that we are turning the corner. For example, businesses are boosting their hiring of temporary employees, which is the sort of thing you would expect them to do before they went the additional step to hiring permanent employees. So, yes, there are reasons to believe that if the improvement in sales and sentiment and exports that we see beginning here continues, that will translate into increased jobs. And by the way, it may also ultimately prove that the valuations of these stock prices are justified.
Can't happen too soon. Greg, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from New York. So the economy may be showing new life, but unemployment and average time out of work remain strikingly high. So do the mounds of resumes that flood human resource departments. The months tick by and the layoffs continue, and many of those looking for work lower their sights. Maybe you. Have you experienced downward mobility firsthand? How far, how fast, and how painful has it been? Will paychecks and positions bounce back with an economic rebound? Or is the old American dream of eternal ascent in trouble? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The president is scheduled to come on and speak to the nation about the power blackout at 8:30. We will turn to the president when and if he comes on. There are reports now of scattered power returning to parts of New York City. But we're looking at a broader movement than just what's happened today across the country, a movement that's affecting a lot of American workers. And joining me in the studio is Tom Kochan, professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management and co-director of the university's Institute of Work and Employment Research. He is co-author of The Mutual Gains Enterprise, Forging a Winning Partnership Among Labor, Management, and Government. Good evening and welcome, Tom Kochan.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Jack, Tom, we're going to be hearing from Americans tonight who have had to recalibrate their careers, their incomes, their lives around downward mobility. But Tom Kochan, give us a sense first of what's going on here. Is the sense that there's downward mobility real, that people are losing ground, that people going back out for new jobs in a slower economy are accepting less and may have to accept less for some time? Is this real?
Oh, this is a very real phenomenon. When workers are permanently displaced in the past, on average, they'd lose 15% to 20% in terms of wages and more likely even more in fringe benefits. But those who really benefited from the dot-com bubble are losing considerably more. They had incomes that were somewhat inflated relative to perhaps their market value, and now they are taking a very big beating in the labor market.
So is this just another backwash from a boom? Is this just the inevitable bust? Or is there something more structural here in the American economy that even on the outer edges of the bust period, it could mean that downward mobility is with us for some time?
Oh, there are several things going on here. Clearly, it's a reaction to the dot-com era, and that's not going to come back. We aren't going to see it just come back in some natural cycle. But there's a deeper phenomenon. American business in the last decade has gone through a process of downsizing workers and laying off people, even when they weren't in desperate straits. And in some respects, they have broken a long-term implicit contract with the American workforce. That's a phenomenon that's been going on for several years. It's not likely to be restored just as the market comes back. And it's a reality that I think American workers have been putting up for a considerable period of time.
Jack Beatty, the last time we talked about the downsizing of the American economy, it was a famous New York Times headline that came just months before the beginning of a bull market like no other bull market, and a boom perhaps like no other boom in American history. So is this downward mobility dynamic
just the fear of the moment, or do you fear it's something that's here to stay for a while?
Well, I do think it's something here to stay for a while because of the underlying economic factors driving it. I mean, what happened to farmers in the 19th century is happening and will happen for the rest of this century to manufacturing workers, to middle managers, to people whose jobs, the hiring hall, extends to Bangladesh. What happened to the farmer was he suffered a calamitous loss of his entire economic position. Partly because the economic policy of the country was decidedly against him. It was a tariff policy. It was a policy in favor of the manufacturer. Today, the manufacturing worker is in a similar situation. The economic policy of the country is decidedly against him. It is all toward the consumer and toward international trade. The farmer was about 50% of the economy and the workforce in 1865, and he was on his way down to the 10% or so of 1910. The manufacturing worker is maybe 15, 16% today, and who knows how low that's going to go. But that is a major, major change. And in the 19th century, it gave rise to a politics of disappointment, the populist revolt, which was the largest radical mass movement in American history, and which foundered really on the sheer weight of the capitalist opposition to it, and which then, from being a left-wing populist movement, became a right-wing populist movement, stressing anti-Semitism, segregation, anti-Catholicism, xenophobia. Ugliness.
So every movement has its political side, every direction of mobility, up or down, talking about manufacturing. But, of course, it's not only in manufacturing that people have taken their lumps in the last couple of years. I want to turn to San Francisco, California, and Bob McPhail joins us. Good evening and welcome, Bob McPhail.
Welcome. How are you doing tonight?
We're doing great, thanks, and we thank you for joining us and for being prepared to tell us a little bit about your story. I understand that your career has taken a path, like many others in America in the last couple of years, that might properly be defined as downward mobility. What's happened in your case, Bob?
Until 2001, I was working for a dot-com here in San Francisco. My salary was very close to $60,000 a year. I was a marketing professional with some technical skills, so my last title was database administrator. The dot-com I was working for went bankrupt at the end of October of 2001. And it took me 13 months to get essentially full-time employment. I am now making about 30% less, and my salary is about what it was in 1995.
So you're making about $40,000 a year. Did you expect that you would have to step back? I mean, after all, everybody came to understand this had been a bubble, or did you expect that somehow, in spite of that, your earnings would stick where they were?
I expected to lose some income. I was actually kind of late in the dot-com burst, and so by the time I was laid off, I had many friends that were unemployed. I survived 5 downsizings at the company that I was with, so I wasn't particularly surprised. I don't think I expected it, to be quite as much, and I certainly didn't expect it to take me 13 months to get a job. I'm 38 years old, and this was the first time since I was 18 that I'd been unemployed.
Was it hard to bite the bullet and take that lower salary? What were the pressures that led you to take it?
My pressure is I have a wife who is 100% disabled, and when you work for a company that goes bankrupt, you don't have COBRA benefits. Fortunately, our insurance company did allow me to buy coverage, but I was paying $600 a month for my health insurance, which I had to have, and making $1,300 a month on unemployment. And so
you needed that health coverage, and there was no two ways about it. Bob, looking forward, you've now stepped back years in terms of your earnings currently. What is your outlook? What's your confidence that you'll get back on the beam?
I think that I will recover somewhat, but I figure I've probably lost 4 to 5 years, and I think to recover to the level I was, I'm going to have to get more education. The problem is, as I'm approaching 40 years old, it gets harder and harder to change careers, and I think my best bet would be to get either an advanced degree in marketing or a law degree to stand any chance of recovering to that kind of salary level.
So downward mobility, no fun, and it looks like you may have to take material steps to turn it around. They won't necessarily be easy. Bob McPhail, thank you for sharing your story from San Francisco tonight.
You're welcome.
We are talking this hour about downward mobility. Americans working for less this year than last. the deteriorating pay and prestige of many American jobs. Which way are we moving here, folks, in our working lives and compensation, up or down? We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join the conversation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about downward mobility, about Americans working for less this year than last. It's the headline on the front page of the Wall Street Journal this week. It's in many American lives. Have you experienced downward mobility firsthand? How far, how fast, how painful has it been? And do you trust that an economic rebound will turn downward mobility up? We'll float your boat again, or do we have some kind of new dynamic going on here? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are told that at 8:30 this evening, the president will address the nation on the power blackout that is today has affected large parts of New York State, on into Cleveland, Detroit, and into Canada. There is power coming back on in scattered parts of New York at this hour, we're told, but it is clearly not all back on. When the president comes on, we will turn to him and bring you that address in full. But right now, I am joined in the studio tonight by Thomas Kochan. He's professor of management at MIT's Sloan School of Management and co-director there of the Institute of Work and Employment Research at MIT. And with our own Jack Beatty. Tom Kochan, before we turn to another example of this downward mobility, we just heard one story from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Dot-com guy was making $60K, managed to ride it for quite a while until well into 2001. The company went broke. Out of work, 13 months looking for a job, the pressure of not having health insurance and a disabled wife at home. He's now working for 30% less than he was making 2 years ago. And it clearly doesn't see exactly when he'll do better again. Is this a typical, atypical? What do you hear in this story?
Well, I think it's very typical of people of his age group. In fact, people who are older than him have taken even bigger hits because they're not going to ever replace the financial losses, both in terms of wages as well as retirement security. The advantage Bob has is he's got years on his side and he's got the right approach by saying he's going to go back and get more education. He's going to keep his technical skills current and he will be ready for the next job opportunities when they come along. But there's another aspect to this. It's this health insurance problem that we have, that we continue to link health insurance and so many of our benefits to the single employer that we happen to work for. Mm-hmm. We've got to address that problem so that the next generation doesn't repeat the same kinds of trauma that he has gone through in trying to care for his disabled wife and meet his family obligations.
And Jack Beatty, in this story, well, you heard it right along with us. You hearkened back to farmers after the Civil War and how they eventually, after punishing economic treatment, got their pitchforks out and became a populist movement. It didn't work out. But here in Bob McPhail's story from San Francisco in 2003, I don't hear him getting his pitchfork. He's ready to go to law school, ready to get an advanced degree. He's still in the game, wants to plunge back in, sort of, you know, build up his resume to try and get back on the escalator, Jack.
Yes, well, he's got the means of production in his head. He's not dependent upon railroads or granaries or, you know, big corporations as the 19th century farmer was to get his stuff to market. So he's in a better position in that respect. But, you know, he's also facing the other side of this, not just the loss of 30% of his income, but the loss of status. One day you are Mr. Beatty. The next day, people don't even see you. One day, you know, you get deference. You're the guy that operates the right machine, or you're the middle manager, or you're a high tech worker. The next day, you're cleaning up in some shop, or you're working at a restaurant, and you're invisible. That kind of blow to status, to self esteem, is a mental health risk. Humiliation and depression are correlated, but it's also a kind of ticking political time bomb. It has always been that through history, through modern history, that status anxiety and the loss of status have pushed people to the left and to the right, but to extremes.
Let's hear another voice, this one from Madison, Wisconsin. We're joined by James Jankiewicz. James, are you there?
I am here, sir.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight, James. And I want to ask in advance your graciousness. At some point, we may have to turn to the President of the United States, and I hope you'll allow us to do that.
Understood. No problem.
But we wanted to get your story, James. You have also gone through this down escalator a bit in the last couple of years. Can you tell us, what did you do? What are you doing now? And what's it done to your earnings, your job status?
I am still looking. I have been a year out looking, and in the meantime, I've taken interim part-time jobs, and one being in a national retail chain. I'm a electronics sales associate, so I'm selling vacuum cleaners and TVs.
So you were a senior consultant at Novell, the big computer networking company.
That was several years ago, and then I became went to some local consulting firms in the Madison area, and they went through a couple downsizes, and I was a victim at the later results of their downsizing with layoffs. Their model became, if you're not billable in 2 weeks, you're out the door.
And so that happened. You are now selling electronics, I don't know, vacuum cleaners and so on, for Sears, as I understand.
Okay, yes, we can say that. You said it. You broke the ice.
So,
I don't know if I should say their name on national.
I think it's fine. Fully reputable firm.
Right.
But maybe not what you were aiming for in your career. What's the impact been for your household income, James?
Well, it's been negligible since it's somewhat a pure commission sales, and I'm at a point I can't quit the job because unemployment would, which I'm still on, would be jeopardized. So I'm kind of it's pure commission on a draw of $6 per hour, and if I quit the job, then I lose unemployment.
So this is a world that I don't completely understand, James. You're drawing unemployment, and at the same time, you're working on a straight, basically commission basis.
It's a part-time 20-25 hour a week job.
Part-time, so you can stay on unemployment in that case.
Right. It gets reduced. I don't get the full benefit.
Right.
I claim. It's complicated, but you could call in and claim your percentage of hours.
But the point is here, you are sucking through a very thin straw, $6 an hour and pure commission selling vacuum cleaners at Sears.
Yes.
This is not rolling in gravy.
No, it is not, sir.
James, James, you're lucky you're living in the state of Wisconsin because they allow that kind of part-time unemployment combination. That's the kind of innovation we should have across the country. Unfortunately, we don't in every state.
But
I don't want to minimize the peril that you're in. I think that we are in a state where there are a lot of people who are piecing together various part-time jobs. We have an increased number of people who are holding two and three jobs just to make ends meet. Most of those are like yours, where the risk of unemployment insurance, the risk of Social Security coverage, the risk of pension and health care all falls on the back of the individual. And I keep wondering when workers are going to say enough is enough. As Jack Beatty said, we've seen revolutions in the past where workers finally get to that breaking point. And I think, frankly, that we may be very close to that in this society.
James, let me ask you, just on that point, I've got a lot of questions, but on that point, do you feel like mounting the barricades here, or do you feel that you're fighting a kind of personal battle to get out of the hole and better your circumstances? Do you feel politically fired up or personally committed to working on your state?
Boy, that's a big one. A lot of those are there. Then in the last year, I've had up and down roller coaster from anger to denial to it's me, no, it's the economy, to all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do. The economy is so bad that employers, it's an employer market, they can sit back and not respond to resumes or calls. It's pretty much they put very specific ads out there with a lot of technical details, and if you don't have one of those, they can eliminate you. So it's really hard to get past the gatekeepers of the companies we apply at. A lot of my group are relating to this. We have a workshop I go to every Monday morning run by Linda Pash at the Dane County Job Center. And through that, we work together and try to figure a way to get jobs in this economy.
James, on the emotional front and the self-image front, Jack Beatty was talking earlier, and all of us can understand what a challenge it is to our self-understanding when a career takes a backward step. How's that been for you? I mean, senior consultant at Novell sounds pretty grand.
I've been walked to a number of big accounts like First Union Bank and Hewitt Associates, and General Mills and City of Detroit, State of Wisconsin, all those accounts, I'd walk in there as the guy that they would go to help them with their technology needs or, you know, strategic planning. And I was not pampered, but I was a road warrior. I was doing all this high-level consulting work and cutting-edge design and, you know, work on their infrastructure, all that kind of stuff.
So when you go to the 4th of July barbecue with the family now or when you're hanging with the neighbors, do you find understanding? You know, some people will have been through this themselves. Others will not have been through it.
Well, that's a good point. My brother-in-law who sat next to me at 4th of July, who was worried about losing his job in sales this September. I'm not sure what happened to him. But anyway, he said to me very frankly after seeing my resume, why don't you have a job? It was a very heartfelt, and it was a question I asked myself, looking at my resume and all my credentials and all that I offer and energy I have for a company, why don't I have a job? I really want to work. I am poised. I am all set to do a lot of what the requirements of these ads and what people, businesses need for, what I've been applying for.
Tom Koch, and James is being very forthright in sharing his circumstances with us. Give back to him in terms of context here. How do you see, how might he see where he sits in the economy?
Well, he's got a lot of company with people who are underemployed. We have, if you add up the unemployment rate and the number who are underemployed, who are working part-time, or the discouraged workers, we're well over 10%, closer to 12% in the economy. That's the reality. I like the fact that, James, you're working with a network of people, both with Dane County, but probably with your colleagues and social networks. Keeping up one's skills, staying current with changes in your profession, building those networks, and then getting active politically. I believe that we need to see American workers demanding of their politicians answers to your good question. Why don't I have a job? What's happening if we are in a knowledge economy? Why don't those of us who have knowledge and skills behind us have the opportunities that we've been trained to perform?
But in the free market era, Tom Koch, the answer that seems to be implicit is, well, look, it's a free market. The market's deciding it. It's not a matter of politics or policy. You don't have a job because that's the way the market's crumbling for you.
Oh,
right,
I don't
now
believe that it's just the free market. Sure, the market forces are operating, but we have been inventive in this country in the past. Go back to Jack's point about the era of the progressives. In the 1930s, we created the New Deal. There was presidential leadership, there was national leadership to say we've got to not leave it to the stock market to solve our problems. We've got to create an infrastructure and a safety net of minimum wages. We've got to grow the economy. We've got to start to support workers' rights to organize and engage in collective bargaining. We've got to get back to those very basic values in the society and ask, how do we temper the market forces so that people can have a fair opportunity to move ahead and have the kind of standard of living we all expect.
And maybe recognize that this is a historic circumstance. This is the first recovery since World War II, half a century back now, in which the number of payroll jobs has continued to fall 20 months into a rebound. We're also seeing here that last month, the share of job seekers, the Wall Street Journal reporting, who had spent at least 15 weeks looking for work was 39.8%, the highest level since the really awful job market of 1983. So It really is a bad scene. James, stand by if you would. I want to bring some callers in. Shira is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Shira. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. I listen to your program all the time, and I'm really excited to be on. My name is Shira. I'm calling because I was a technical writer. I was making $73,000 a year, and I lost my job a year ago. I live in Massachusetts. And I've been looking and looking, and I've gotten occasional short-term writing and editing jobs, but I haven't been able to get a real job. And it's very dismaying because the bills are due, and the creditors really don't care why you don't have the money. If you don't have it, you don't have it. And I'm afraid of ultimately losing my house.
So, sure. How many months now out of a job?
13.
It's a long time. Have you had offers that you've turned away from because you just didn't think they were good enough?
No. I took the tactic of collecting full unemployment and totally looking for a job rather than working part-time at a less skilled job and collecting a lower amount of unemployment. I decided to just go full force and look for a professional job.
Are you still sticking with that approach, or is it beginning to occur to you that maybe you may have to work at a lower compensation, even in a field that you hadn't thought of yourself working in?
Well, I have no choice now. My unemployment ran out last week, and I'm doing my budget, and I'm going to have to take anything at this point that's reasonable.
How do you define reasonable then, Cheryl?
Well, since I have knee problems, anything that doesn't involve standing, basically, or, you know, something unsavory, illegal,
That's setting the bar fairly low. You're pretty open to whatever you can find at this point.
Yes, but that would be as a temporary job.
Of
While
course.
I did that to bring in some money, I would continue to look for a professional job, and if not as a technical writer, perhaps as an editor, ESL teacher, tutor, various other related skills I have that all relate to writing.
But really, really ready to look around. James Jankowicz in Madison, you can hear a fellow traveler.
Right, and what we came up with is that, yeah, we can get part-time jobs or any job, $8, $9, $10 an hour, but for us to support our families, basically $15 an hour is our bare minimum to even keep afloat, and those are even hard to come by. So to spend time looking for a part-time job or an interim job or even a low-paying job of that nature, we have competition with entry-level people and other workers. So for us professionals looking for those kind of jobs, then we find out we're shut out from those even.
So pretty soon you can really be tumbling. Sure, thanks very much for your call. Tom Kolkin, does there come a point where people say, look, I've just got to take whatever I can get? And what happens to people's personal circumstances when they really drop down a full notch or two notches?
Well, Cher is at that point. When unemployment insurance runs out, that's when people start to adjust their expectations and often then lower them and take whatever job is available. But that leads to employers feeling that they're hiring overqualified people. They're reluctant to do that. There's frustration on the job. Often what you see then is a cycle of very rapid turnover because people don't like the conditions, can't support themselves, and so the frustration continues to build. All you can hope for in that situation is that people don't lose their self-esteem, their self-confidence, and their drive to continue to look for the kind of work that will be satisfying and use their skills most productively. But that's a hard, hard thing to do. And many people are in that situation right now.
James, we've just got a few more seconds with you. Where do you hope to find yourself a year out?
I'm hoping to get reestablished. I've been close. I was one of two. I was one of eight. I got a phone interview tomorrow morning with the panel. I'm going to just keep hacking away. A year from now, good Lord, I didn't think I'd be here last winter. So
who knows?
Yes.
Well, go with our best wishes. We hear your determination, and we're hoping that it pans out well for you. James Jankowicz, thanks very much for joining us from Madison,
Thank you.
Wisconsin.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're talking tonight about downward mobility, about Americans working for less this year than last. You can join this conversation. Have you experienced downward mobility firsthand? Is the American dream of eternal ascent in trouble? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Now, we promised to bring you President Bush when he comes on. We thought it was going to be live from the White House. It turns out he's taping a message to the country on the big power blackout today. We will bring that taped message from President Bush to you at the end of this hour. So stick with us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Support for this, Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about downward mobility, a phrase that nobody likes to hear, but it is a reality. Americans working for less this year than last, and in fairly substantial numbers. You're welcome to join the conversation tonight. We have a lot of questions. Is what Abraham Lincoln called the right to rise at stake here? Are you confident that your economic and social path is still generally on an upward course? Can you imagine living on half of what you make now? Have you had to do it? And why isn't there more public anger about this trend? It's on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Are we just too ashamed to talk about it with one another? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, we are tracking the big power blackout this evening throughout this hour. There is more news in. Cleveland officials saying now that without the power needed to pump water there to 1.5 million people, their water reserves are running low. 50 million people living in affected areas tonight. 9 nuclear power reactors, 6 in New York, and 1 each in New Jersey, Ohio, and Michigan, all shut down because of the loss of off-site power. President Bush has been taping a message to the nation tonight. If we can get that for you before the end of the hour, we will play it at the end of the hour. But we're not sure exactly the status of that taped message from the president right now. But if and when it comes in, we will play it for you before the hour's out. I'm joined tonight in the studio looking at downward mobility in careers by Tom Kochan. He's professor of management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, by our own Jack Beatty, and right now from Santa Cruz, California, by Michael McGuire. Hello, Michael. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks so much for joining us. We've been hearing some very interesting stories tonight. We'd like to hear yours. As I understand it, not long ago, you were a senior marketing writer with a software company in California. Now you give trombone lessons. What's happened?
Well, what happened was that I got recruited, hired, and downsized all within 3 months.
Ouch.
A month or two after that, I took what was available, which was a program directorship with a nonprofit at half of what I'd been making. That ran out of money when the state cut the budget, and then it's been cut about in half again. So I've gone from roughly 65 to about 12 over the course of about a year and a half.
That is that's what they call rough sledding, Michael. And now you're giving...
They put a bunch of rocks on the bobsled run. What can I tell you?
I think so. And now you're giving trombone lessons. Is this a labor of love or a labor of last resort?
Probably a little of both. It's something I have done all of my life at one time or another. Now I'm just having to push it a lot harder than I used to.
So how surprised, how stunned, how are you?
Well, it's more numb than stunned at this point. It's been a year since I had a full-time job, and I would have to say that I'm surrounded by stunned people. I belong to a networking organization whose primary purpose is to find professionals work, and for some, it's working quite well. My significant other has had more interviews than anybody knows what to do with. It kind of depends on your skill set. Marketing writers are roughly a dime a dozen, and now they're asking that you not only be a marketing writer, but that you have an intimate relationship with just about every graphics package of software there is out there, which is almost impossible to find.
So everybody knows there was a boom and there was a bust. Do you feel like you just got caught in that whipsaw, Michael, or do you feel that you're part of some longer-term process here?
Oh, I think I got caught with a dot-bomb when the dot-bomb happened. The interesting thing is that very recently, a couple of friends of mine, friends that I'd met through the networking thing and then a little further out, have decided that since we can't get anybody to hire us, we're going to hire ourselves and take some new technology to market, and that is looking extremely promising. So I think there are things out there, but, man, I'm telling you, the old job search just doesn't work anymore. You've got to find an incredibly creative way to go about it. You've got to be a marketeer before you have skill sets so that you can sell yourself to somebody. And then if you succeed, you're going to be part of a very small minority of people who actually make it work.
So you're turning entrepreneurial in that vacuum.
Yeah, don't have much choice. If you have the abilities to talk, if you have abilities to sell, if you can find something that is going to turn the world on its ear or its head or whatever you want to call it, then by all means, do it. Because I don't see anything else that's looming over the horizon that's going to be particularly terrific. I've even signed up for retraining through the California program that will pay for that to learn something called digital media, which is supposed to start in September. And if you do that in the state of California, then your unemployment kicks in again.
So you've got,
I just got my last check, so it'd be nice to have that happen.
It would be. We feel your hands on the bootstraps there, Michael.
Yanking hard.
Yanking hard, and we hear the verve that must have made you a pretty darn good marketing writer. We wish you real good luck in getting back on the beam, and in the meantime, a trombone can be a beautiful thing, if not highly remunerative.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for joining us from Santa Cruz tonight, Michael.
You're more than welcome.
Tom Kochan there, yet another story. And it all leaves me wondering whether, again, about this boom and bust cycle that we saw so clearly, Why shouldn't Americans think that, you know what, one way or another, this is just another bump in the road, that the story of the American economy has been, over long periods, a story of upward direction, of ascent? Is there really a reason to think that if you look out over some period, and it may not be an easy period, but if you look forward, you know, I don't know, another 2 years, another 5 years, some period, that things will get back on that upward glide?
I don't think there's any natural market force that's going to bring us back on the upward glide in the short run. What Michael is doing is exactly the right thing to do, to build a network, to try to get on top of the next generation of technology, to build a new business. If we are creative in this society and working with those resources by bringing the best of our universities, MIT or Stanford or the local state university systems, mm-hmm. to really help build the next generation technology, to build entrepreneurial organizations, we'll get some of the economic development. But I believe it's going to take a longer time, and it's going to wait until the baby boom moves through this labor force to retirement age and we have a shortage again of workers. Then the next generation will be able to prosper, but it's going to be a very angry and frustrated next generation, because they're going to be left with picking up the pieces for people who don't have the retirement income that they thought they were going to have, who are going to live a longer period of time, who are going to have to keep on working part-time, and they are going to have to help provide the support, and they're going to be asking, where's the income coming from? We don't have the hours to put in the labor force. We don't have another spouse to add to the labor force, and so we're going to at some point have to start increasing wages again, something we haven't done in this country for a long time for the average worker.
Now, how does that work economically? I mean, it's, you can't just wave a magic wand and increase wages, can you?
No, you have to keep increasing productivity. You have to keep staying innovative. You have to keep flexible so that you can build the next generation of products and stay on top of the economy, not try to compete on the basis of low labor costs. That means corporations have to be very innovative. That means workers have to be given a voice in their corporations to make sure that they're investing in strategies that build long-term sustainability and long-term jobs.
Have there been other plateaus like the one that you're now projecting, which is, if I hear you correctly, could go on for a decade or more in American history, comparable to what we're embarking on now? Have there been other times when what Lincoln called the right to rise became as ephemeral as you seem to be predicting it is about to become?
Probably the only time that's parallel, and it was a much more severe time, was the 1930s. After the booming 1920s, the 30s were clearly that decade. That was saved by World War II and saved by the buildup of the defense industry. We've seen sectors go through this, and we're seeing it now. The aerospace industry after the Cold War has been in this kind of downward cycle for a long time. The travel industry, the airline industry, is in it now, and there's no end in sight for that industry to recover to anything close to where it was in the past. So there are parallels, but not as widespread across the economy.
We're talking downward mobility. Nobody likes it, but it's a fact in many people's lives. Betty is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Betty. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great, thanks.
You know, one of the things that's hard about being unemployed is not being able to give to your public radio.
We forgive you, Betty.
Oh, thank you.
but come like back to us
food?
When you hit the big time.
Yeah, food or...
Right. Yeah, okay, medicine or public radio, okay.
Yeah,
what's your story, Betty? Have you been through that roller coaster?
Oh, yeah. I was doing high-tech marketing in the graphic arts industry, which, if anybody comes out of that background, knows that that's a triple whammy right there.
Mm-hmm.
And so back in the heyday, we were all working so insanely, I burnt out, so I quit my job.
I'll grab the trapeze when I'm good and ready, thank you.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then I started up my own consulting business again, and the bottom dropped out. So fortunately, I was frugal, and I saved a lot of money. But I think if we could take what Lincoln said about we have the right to rise, I think in America what we have is the right to reinvent ourselves.
But, Betty, I'm reading here on my screen that you're now working at a convenience store.
Oh, I was working at a convenience store. I was cashier girl.
That's a long way from the high trapeze.
You know, I have to tell you, I am an extrovert. I needed to get out of the house. and I needed to be mixing it up and networking.
I
had my own networking survival groups and different friends that would help me through, but I just needed to get out and feel like I was interacting. And I started networking with the people who would come in every day. And one Sunday in the Boston Globe, well, actually, I should back up. I listened to NPR all the time, and I was reading all of the different information on what sectors were growing. And I thought, okay, 2 years ago, I abandoned the graphic arts market, and I tried to reinvent myself. I was going out with life science technology companies to market myself.
So you're really looking for where the hot edge was.
Yeah.
Where did you end up aiming?
Well, I started focusing on healthcare and finance.
Okay.
And I tried as best I could to get into the healthcare. There was an opening here in town at one of the local hospitals for a director of PR and marketing. I sent in my resume. I found someone who knew the president and CEO of the hospital. I had like a personal letter introduction to them. I was invited to an open house that was for realtors only. I had a friend of mine who's a realtor invite me in, and the president of the hospital and I were talking and really connecting, and then afterwards I went up to say that I was really impressed with what he was going to do at the hospital. He said, oh, what real estate company do you work for? And I said, okay, you caught me. And then told him that I was applying for the job, and he remembered my resume, said, I'm going to put it to the top of the list.
Oh, boy, so you were really working every angle. At the end of all that, Betty, from the high point you were at, I don't know how many months ago, to where you think you'll be, is it below, is it equal, is it above?
Oh, I'm now making. So anyway, at the convenience store, I had the perfect fly under the radar to downward mobility.
So that let you pay some electricity bills, but where do you think you're going to end up this leap?
Well, what happened is I ended up, because I got to know people, there was an opening at a financial company down the street, Partners First Mortgage, and they had an opening for a telemarketer, and they only knew me as cashier girl.
Hey, but you're tailor-made, and we can hear it. Bottom line, are you better off now than you were 3 years ago?
Oh, no. I'm making a third of what I need to be making. I'm a single woman I own my own house.
So you went through the triple backflips. You did everything. You snuck into the King's Parlor, and it's still a third of what you were making then. Betty, our time's running down, but we love you, and we wish you well. Thanks for calling. Jack Beatty, you're patiently listening there in the background, and I hear now that the president's remarks are not going to come to us during this hour, but we'd like to hear what you're thinking about all this, Jack.
Well, you know, the right to rise, Abraham Lincoln's phrase, the main enemy of that in his lifetime, or rather just after his lifetime, was industrial capitalism. The right to rise was, in his notion, the right to employ yourself. Wage labor and the corporation and industry ended that notion of the right to rise. And for whole classes of people, for whole generations of people, there was you could rise, but only within the same. You could be the factory hand, your son could be the other the slightly better job at the factory, and so on.
But that also turned America into the economic powerhouse of the world.
Right. But today, the main enemy of the right to rise is investor capitalism, a capitalism that is run for the bottom line, for the stock price. A capitalism essentially that is run for speculators. And that is what we have in this country. That's what downsizing is all about. AT&T could lay off 30,000 people in 1996 and the stock price would go up. That's a kind of barbarism. That's not humane.
Well, but it's sure what we've got. Tom Kokin, you're looking years out.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a response to this. I think we're beyond the shareholder maximizing days. I think employees, communities are asking for more. The only question is when their voices will be heard and what political leaders and what business leaders and what labor leaders are going to respond.
Tom Kokin, co-director of the Institute of Work and Employment Research at MIT, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack, great as always to have you on.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR and WRNI. Coming up just ahead at 9 o'clock, it's All Things Considered.